Welcome to the podcast series from the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration 2023, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations, organized by the European Migration Network in Slovakia. You're listening to the lecture entitled Migration and Health, Challenges and Needs Across Migration Cycle by Nassim Majidi. Nassim is the co-founder of Samuel Hall, a social enterprise that conducts research, and head of Migration Pillar, where she leads evidence-based research and policy development on migration and displacement. Nassim is known for her work as an expert on return and reintegration, and more broadly on durable solutions to displacement, migrant aspirations, and cross-border mobility. She has developed impactful strategic programming initiatives, national policies on migration, and monitoring reviews. Enjoy the lecture.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. Again, it's great to be here every year with you. Today, I was asked to give a lecture on health challenges in the migration cycle. As was just explained, this is the result of some collaboration with IOM. The report is actually public and on our website and on IOM's website. A podcast just came out as well, where you'll hear not just my voice, but the voice of medical specialists, of IOM staff, including in Ethiopia, who speak to these challenges. So if you're interested to know more, the podcast is now also available. I'll also be adding material from another project and a country that's close to my heart, Afghanistan. But let's go through the slides together, and hopefully we will also have time for questions at the end. So first, what is the link between migration and health? So let's try to start with some introduction slides to unpack the connection that exists between migration and health. As we all know, the numbers of migrants and of forcibly displaced individuals has reached record levels this year. So we really need to step up our efforts to meet their health needs. What we also know with the context of COVID is how much our health systems, national health systems, must be prepared for sudden shocks, for different types of health emergencies, but also health needs caused by conflicts, climate change, and other disasters. And this is true not just at the point of origin. Again, COVID has shown how much these needs are global. So really the focus of our talk today will not just be on the needs and context of origin, but also in transit and destination. So these needs really go beyond borders. They result all over these different steps of the migration cycle. They result in migrants often facing limited access to healthcare due to their status as migrants. Now, refugees and other migrants face the same health determinants as the general population, but their migration status adds a layer of complexity and vulnerability that can negatively impact their health when combined with other factors. What you see on your right here is an adjusted model of a very famous model of health determinants, which basically is a model that we use to determine health inequalities and how the relationships between individuals, their environment, and health interact. And this is something that the World Health Organization uses. And there's different classifications or categories they use that we can adapt to the migration, return, and reintegration conversation. So first of all, we have to remember that there are individual characteristics and behaviors. And so these include, as you can see, at the center of the circle, gender, personal behavior, age, disability. And focusing on these individual characteristics, as you'll see in a second, matters because we know from research that migrant women and girls face the greatest threats, for example, in terms of physical and sexual violence, and have specific health needs around childbirth, hygiene, and physical security. We also know in this conversation that we have to keep a focus on unaccompanied or separated children who are also at particular risk of physical and sexual violence, but also mental health disorders. So we have to keep these different individual characteristics in mind. But then if we shift to the social and economic environments, another key finding from the literature is that the level of education has an impact on health and health status and well-being. Yet what we also know is that migration often results in an interruption of education, and that the lower levels of education or access to education that migrants may face also then has an impact on their physical and mental health outcomes. Same with their ability to gain an income or their ability to have access to decent jobs. All of those for migrants have an additional impact on their health. And then finally, we have the physical environments in which migrants find themselves. And you've probably discussed already this morning the very difficult environments that they face in contexts like Libya, for example. And all of those environments will have specific shocks on their health, but also whether their work environments are safe. And we know most oftentimes for migrants, especially in transit, they will face what we call the three Ds: dirty, dangerous, and demanding jobs. And all of those have an impact on their health. So the experience of migration, we know, is a determinant of health. And studying that more closely is exactly what we embarked on through two pieces of research. And so I will first take you and zoom in on the focus of our talk today, which is on health and reintegration. And this is, again, you have the cover photo here. This is the study that we conducted in six countries. They included Brazil, Ethiopia, the Gambia, Georgia, Pakistan, and Senegal. And we wanted to have a range of different countries from different geographies and continents, but also different levels of national healthcare systems to try to see what are the key issues upon return for migrants. And then I'll give you a bit of a snapshot specifically on mental health to really have us think more about what we can do to bring responses to the needs of migrants. And here, so zooming in on the study with IOM on return and reintegration, I wanted to start with a quote. So here, maybe I'll give you just a few seconds to read this quote from a migrant originally from Zambia. He says, "I realized I had all these health problems when I returned from Libya. Migrants like him were subjected to beatings randomly on any part of our bodies. Sleeping conditions were very bad as we slept on the ground, even when it was wet. Food was not adequate and no medical care was given to us, even to the sick. The security forces were heartless and racist." So this is Joseph, whose name was changed, who was interviewed in the Gambia upon his return, but remembering all the issues and health concerns that he had faced. And if you look at this more closely, then he identifies two shocks. First of all, the very specific conditions of transit in Libya. But then he also explains in the first sentence the realization he had upon return of the range of medical issues and needs he had. So while he was in Libya, while he was still a migrant, he was in fight mode. He had to cope with all of the challenges he was facing. But he hadn't yet had the time to actually realize everything he had been experiencing. So that realization didn't come before his return, but after his return. And as we all know, the literature on return and reintegration tells us from the last 20 years that if there's not enough information, not enough preparedness, then there will in all likelihood not be a sustainable reintegration. So not only is he sick ill and needs proper care, he also needs information and preparedness. So let's remember Joseph as we talk through the next slides. GLC is from IOM's own data, and this shows again that Joseph is not alone. 58% of migrants in a vulnerable situation who were assisted to return by IOM in 2021 had presented health-related needs. So basically, we know that the majority of returnees will have some specific health needs. So we're not talking about a minority, we're talking about a majority. And although we know that good health and well-being are a basic right for all, our research has shown that efforts to realize this right exclude migrants and exclude returnees even when they go back home. And this was one of the key findings from our study. So we embarked on this study funded by the EU and the IOM Knowledge Management Hub to explore the links between health needs, access to care, and sustainable reintegration. And so we collected data from 500 people across the 6 countries that I had just mentioned to you. And we looked at the literature on the determinants of health and really broke down our data collection to understand what was the health situation at the point of origin, what was it in transit and at the host country, and what is it upon return. And really what you see is an accumulation and growing of health needs, as you can see on this graph, with a decrease in overall health status, more stressors, and a decrease in reintegration success. So overall, in a nutshell, what our assumption was that there would be fragmentation in healthcare and that there would be different types of health needs along the way. Actually, our findings showed us that it's not just about fragmentation or about different health needs along the way or upon return. It's the fact that the problem grows throughout the migration cycle, and by the time returnees return, their national healthcare systems are not equipped to face the demand, and they're also not informed and not prepared. So this is where this concept of integrated care, which is part of the programming and the work of specialized agencies like WHO, really comes into play. Because what we found in our research, we mapped in all of those 6 countries the different healthcare systems. And what we find is that there's a lack of migration-aware healthcare systems overall, globally, and then upon return specifically. So we actually found that many public health interventions struggle to respond not just to the needs of returnees, but remember the different groups of migrants, the different groups of returnees, whether it's women, girls, unaccompanied minors, or adults. And so one finding that cuts across all of our countries of review is that healthcare is fragmented, is ad hoc, and usually doesn't include migrants into the national healthcare response, at least not immediately, not upon return, immediately upon return. And so again, I think it's important for us to remember that the migrant doesn't come with health problems, the context of their migration causes the health problems. And here I'll give you one very easy fact that I'll ask you to remember from my research. You must have heard before, at least I have, from governments of countries of origin, that they often complain that their young men leave healthy and come back unhealthy. I have often heard, our healthy young men go, you send them back sick. And there's some truth to that. One killer fact from this report is what you see here. Only 1% of our respondents, 1%, reported poor health before leaving, before their migration. And this goes up to, I'm sorry, you can't see it properly here, up to 37% upon return. So 1% leave in poor health. So basically, most migrants leave in good health. And then when they return, they actually 37% of those that we sampled, and it wasn't a representative sample, but it's indicative enough, 37% actually have health concerns prior to their return, just in the phase pre-return. And so this really speaks to the fact that, first of all, we should have representative data, and we should be monitoring the health needs, given how big the gap is in terms of their health before return, before leaving and after they return. So one of the first key messages then of our study is that the majority of returnees had good health prior to migration, and their health systematically deteriorates. But critical recognition here of unsafe practices that migrants are exposed to. Now, the second fact that I'd like you to remember is that this was most pronounced among female returnees and among men who were caught in situations of exploitation. So here, for example, I'm referring to labor exploitation, where men reported bone fracture, loss of limb, eye injuries, skin burns. Women were telling us about abusive practices, for example, in some specific sectors, and physical injuries that they had also suffered from beatings. And then we have the specific cases of migrants who find themselves in camps with ear infections. Some had epilepsy episodes, and then the overall general physical violence that they're subject to. So these are just some examples of what they're subject to in transit. And upon return then to their countries of origin, they face what we often refer to as a dual burden, not just physical, long-term physical health problems, but also mental health problems. And we've seen this in the literature on the stigma related to return, on the fact that returnees may come back to an unsupportive environment. And that also adds to their psychosomatic symptoms. Now, similarly, because of this unsupportive environment, because of that stigma, actually our research shows that some returnees are actually unwilling to seek medical care for their health needs, because that might reveal that they were irregular migrants. And this happened, for example, in one case of a Senegalese migrant who we spoke to. A Senegalese returnee who had a gunshot wound while he was crossing borders, he refused to get treatment upon return, because then he thought that would reveal to his whole family, to other people in the community, what he had to go through and the conditions of his migration. In Ethiopia and Pakistan, similarly, we found that returnees were reluctant to open up about personal health issues, including mental health, because they simply thought others wouldn't understand their situation. So the challenges go as much from the structural level of health systems not including them, to communities and environments where they feel that they won't be included, and they themselves might actually step back from accessing or relying on healthcare. But overall, if you look back at the countries that we selected for this study, and again, they represent a range. What we found is that in countries without universal health coverage, returnees often experienced not only delays in terms of their care, but no care at all, often, with long-term health consequences. And one of the big issues that returnees will have, especially if they returned after being away in the country of destination for a while, is that the difference, the variation between the health system, let's say in Europe, and the health system when they come back, creates issues not just in terms of the quality, but also the continuity of care that we were talking about, and this concept of integrated care. For example, several returnees mentioned they had been taking regular medication for chronic conditions in their host countries. So something that was trivial and well taken care of in their host countries. But they were unable to continue their medication post-return for different reasons, whether the high cost of medication or simply the unavailability of medication in the country of origin. So these are really the levels I want you to reflect on, from the national to the community levels, but also the barriers to access continuity of care, which were not faced in the host country, or which might not be faced by other members of the country of origin, by the general population. And as we'll reflect, and I'm going to turn to some good practices to not just highlight the negatives. In our report, what we try to do is to really reflect on these questions of access. And here, again, for example, on accessibility, what many returnees told us was they actually lacked information. They lacked knowledge or know-how of the system upon return. And all over the world, social security systems, health systems, are part of national systems that are often the most difficult to navigate in Europe or anywhere else in the world, and even more so in countries of origin. So the number of returnees who had to also travel more than 1 hour to health facilities increased from 10% pre-migration to 20% post-return. So that implied that they had more difficulties accessing healthcare, higher transportation costs, and that they were in a way more marginalized from their health system. I mentioned acceptability. Returnees were often afraid not to be accepted or mentioning that they had health problems, as they thought that would be a barrier to their reintegration. In the host country, oftentimes they're more anonymous. Once they return, as I mentioned, there are concerns over stigma and other issues. And finally, there are administrative and legal barriers. So some said that actually they don't just return to their country of origin as citizens. One returnee was unable to continue even post-surgical rehabilitation care upon return because he was told that the accident and the surgery had happened outside of his country, and so that any care wouldn't be taken on board by the national health system after return. Another returnee explained that he was given expired cancer medicine, which he had to accept because he was told that that's the best the healthcare system could offer him, because he didn't yet have all the legal documentation and paperwork to be able to be integrated in the national health system. So there are real administrative and legal barriers to address. So if we turn to some good practices then. So here we've listed on the left several criteria that we can use to identify and to plan for stronger health responses. So what we did in our research is we mapped out across the 6 countries, we identified 47 different programs or services, often not led by the governments in the countries of origin, but by IOM, by NGOs, by civil society organizations, by private health care service providers, and in some cases also the public health sector. But what we found overall was that there were gaps in the formal healthcare system, and actually that it was IOM, the NGOs, the CSOs, that were the principal providers of healthcare for returnees. And so for donors, this is something very important to remember, that, again, IOM and other actors are playing an essential role in providing a continuity of care that otherwise isn't at all available to returnees. So, for example, let's take a few examples of good practices. On affordability, so we know cost is one of the big barriers to accessing healthcare. So in some countries, IOM provided reimbursement for medical expenses. So I think in Georgia, for example, for Georgian returnees, that was up to 1,500 euros. So that was meant to fill that transition gap while returnees were waiting to be integrated into the local public health system. An example was NGOs in Pakistan supporting with to pay for COVID treatments. So there are different examples also of how certain host countries will provide financial support to returnees' health needs, for example, France and Switzerland have that built into their reintegration support. And so what we need here is to ensure that that type of reintegration support is systematic across all countries and not dependent on which country or which donor is funding it. If we look now at, for example, availability and accommodation, what we saw is that returnees widely took up counseling services. So when those counseling services were available, returnees for the majority would actually take them up. So IOM country offices assisted returnees to acquire medication by ensuring that they were providing them with advice, with counseling, but also by identifying exactly which type of medicine would be needed and also organizing the import of medicine from the host country. So, for example, from Germany to Georgia. So our research in Georgia showed that that was one of the best practices where IOM was actually involved in ensuring that the supply chain of medication from the country of destination to the country of origin was also accompanying the return and reintegration process. Now, in terms of appropriateness, in some cases, medical doctors are included on flights back to the country of origin. Or in some cases, health providers provide specialist care specifically for female returnees. So, for example, in obstetrics and gynecology, and there's been additional training provided, referrals provided to make sure that that's accessible and possible. So there are different opportunities here, different best practices that have been documented in our research and that could definitely be learned from and scaled. Now, in terms of the more structural recommendations, based on the gaps that we identified, we formulated some key structural recommendations. And so while, of course, the in-kind support and the financial assistance that we just underlined are key, the most sustainable long-term interventions would require actually building a continuum of care for migrants by assessing their health needs before and after return and by piloting new health insurance methods throughout their journey or by reinforcing the national health systems in their countries of origin. And this is obviously where we get into the conversation around development and reintegration and seeing reintegration not just from a short-term perspective, but really a long-term perspective. Now, our sample size for female returnees was small. We only managed to interview 55 female returnees, but our findings, even with that caveat, indicates, and I believe Professor Siegel is in the room and her team led a study on the gendered impact of reintegration. We know from different literature and we know from our study that health in reintegration is a specific gendered experience. So a lot of our recommendations have to do with how we can ensure that female returnees who actually report are more likely to report chronic health conditions than male returnees across all of their stages of migration can be assisted. And again, in terms of the issues that were reported in our interviews, we had everything from uterus infection to miscarriage, postpartum depression, other pregnancy complications, psychological stress. All of these are documented in the report, and all of these have answers too that really require a specific focus on how to support women, especially as the psychosocial impact, the mental health impact of all these health issues is quite strong on women who are in their marriage or reproductive ages and who feel the pressures of their communities and their societies around them. So upon return, this is really one of the big recommendations of this report, and we detail some possible interventions along those lines. And obviously, all of this has to do with reinforcing screening and referrals upon return. Again, it can be facilitated even in this transition period by IOM and others by facilitating, for example, telehealth service for returnees who may face barriers in access to care. Again, just having that conversation that screening will be a step towards the referral. So this includes mental health screenings, to be able to include returnees into different psychosocial well-being programs, for example, if mental health is the key issue there. But of course, and again, the key element at the most structural level will be to ensure that we fill in the gap that I highlighted at the start, which was of a lack of migration-aware health systems. So really focusing on building those health systems at national, regional, and in international levels, and combining reintegration funding with development funding to support public health systems. And as a researcher, I can't conclude my recommendations without saying that we need more data. We need longitudinal data on returnees' health and reintegration outcomes to see more of the interactions over time. Now, zooming in on mental health, and again, because I think this is now widely accepted that there is a specific mental health component to migration and reintegration specifically. There was another study that we conducted last year with IUM in Afghanistan specifically. And here, the reason why I want to talk about it a bit more briefly than I talked about the other study is mainly because there's often the assumption by countries of destination, by donors, that once people get back home, their communities will take them in. Their communities will handle them. And that their communities are basically able to handle the stresses or mental health stressors that are available. But actually, what do you do when community health is on the decline? And this is another layer of the health and migration conversation. Community health is actually a term that WHO uses, the World Health Organization, to basically refer to when communities no longer have the resources to take care of their own. And so in our research, we looked specifically at that. We looked specifically at community health. And what we found in Afghanistan, and again, it won't be shocking to many of you given what the country has been facing since August 2021, but what we found is that community health is on the decline, which means that communities cannot support the needs, including the health care needs of their own. And in this context, actually, mental health conditions are even more heavily stigmatized within society. And of course, the gender differences, again, for returnees is a key element, but also for the women left behind, for the many women who might themselves be displaced, or whose husbands have left. And so here we've seen that, again, in countries like Afghanistan, the mental health causes don't just stop at transit, destination, return, and reintegration. They last over time because the responses from their societies are also gendered. And this is, again, something we heard in our six-country study for IOM previously as well, is that it's not just that the national healthcare systems aren't integrating migrants or the health needs of those who have been displaced, but that the response is also often gendered. In many societies, including those that we surveyed for IOM across the six countries, men are often seen as being more justified in accessing healthcare because they will be able to then fulfill certain roles, including livelihoods that a woman might not be seen as being able to take on. So the response is also gendered, and women are often excluded by their own societies as well, which again leads us to think about what incentives can be given, what support can be given to men, women, to their communities to actually be able to reintegrate returnees. In contexts like Afghanistan, oftentimes men will say no to healthcare, to certain surgeries that NGOs might be providing, because they don't know what the impact on their women will be. So they often just refuse. Is it just about information? Is it about also providing cash-based incentives? These are all the conversations that we need to have. And again, remembering that both these community and individual perspective will be needed, and that there can't be any reintegration, any durable solution without mental health support at a community level. So I just wanted to leave you with this concept of community health and understanding that if community health isn't reinforced, then sustainable reintegration will also not be a possible or possible outcome. And so if we think about more programming recommendations, and previously I went into some of the more structural policy or normative frameworks. If we think about very concrete recommendations in terms of programs, basically health has to be integrated in any programming intervention that's done to support returnees or populations on the move. So one of our big recommendations across countries like Afghanistan is that actually for returnees, you have to include mental health, psychosocial services, MHPSS programs into all of your livelihood programming, community programming, so that we can destigmatize these health issues, so that we can create more awareness and work with communities to also support returnees, women, men, whoever they are, to be reintegrated. And so that we can rebuild the resources of communities to be able to reintegrate migrants. So now I'd like to open up to you, because I'm sure you have also from your own experiences, research, and whoever else is in the room, your own perspectives to how we can overcome these challenges and ensure that health support reaches those who need it the most. And there's just one final resource that I can share with you, and I have to share all of the resources with you also after the presentation. It's this collaboration we had with the ERIN Network last year, where we basically worked with the Technical Working Group on Reintegration and Development to develop an operational framework. Basically, how do you operationalize the link between reintegration and development from the country of destination to the country of origin? And so this has all to do about setting some standards. And so as we talk about return and reintegration, as we talk about linkages between countries of destination and countries of origin, these types of specialized health initiatives really are a development conversation. If we're talking about referral systems into public or private healthcare provision, if we're really talking about long-term development initiatives. So this report gives an operational framework of how to bring in development actors to join the conversation and the planning on reintegration, so that it's not just a conversation that's led by actors involved in return, but that it really is a conversation led by development actors who are there to support governments at context of origin. How can we basically link better reintegration and development initiatives to include referral systems, to be better at screening and monitoring and anticipating needs? Again, the needs are those of a majority of returnees and really need to be addressed. Thank you, and over to you.
This lecture was part of the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations. The seminar is organized by the International Organization for Migration Slovakia as the coordinator of the Slovak EMN National Contact Point. This activity is funded by the European Union and co-funded by the Ministry of Interior of the Slovak Republic. Thank you for listening.